Okay? So, before this point, there is no known historical existence of Codex Vaticanus. Okay? But, understand, this sets it apart though a little bit from Codex Sinaiticus, right? Do we have any known record of that codex existing at all before Tischendorf found something in 1844?
No.
No, we have no record of that historically, right? There is an entry in the catalog in the Vatican Library in the year 1475 that this codex was in the possession of the Vatican, it was in the Vatican's possession in that particular year, okay? There's no historical record before that, and to this day, there is a call number or a catalog number on the manuscript that is 1209. That's the same number that they originally assigned to it when they entered it into the log in 1475. Okay, so you understand how libraries work. They have referencing systems so that you can locate information in the library. Okay, maybe some of you didn't know that, but that's the way it is. So, Arras in 1521. Okay, 1521, Erasmus reports differ, okay? I've read some sources that say in 1521, Erasmus went to the Vatican Library and looked at the document. So let me just say one more thing about that. So 1521, Erasmus is working on his third edition of the Greek New Testament, okay? Now, obviously, this is going to be the text that Luther and Tyndall are going to use to translate the Bible, spelled Tyndall wrong, that Luther and Tyndall are going to use to translate the Bible into German and English, okay? But in 1521, Erasmus either goes to the Vatican himself and looks at it, or writes to the prefect or the head librarian of the Vatican Library and asks about the reading in 1 John 5:7, the Johannine Common, okay? This is a famous verse about, and I want you to just go there quick so you know what I'm talking about. Go in your Bible, 1 John 5:7. So the sources disagree somewhat on whether or not Iran, and I'm just saying that for the sake of historical honesty. I would love to be able to tell you right now that I could say for sure that he actually went and looked at it himself, but I can't do that at this point. All I can say is that there are conflicting reports about whether he actually went himself or whether he just wrote to the chief librarian and asked about this. But the verse in question is 1 John 5:7, where it says, there are three that bear record in heaven, the Father, the Word, and the Holy Ghost, and these three are one. So this is a verse on the idea of the Trinitarian view of God, right? So modern versions are going to leave that verse out or offset it, footnote it, mark it off, and say it's not in the two oldest and best manuscripts, okay? Because that verse is not in Codex Vaticanus, okay? Now, but why this is important is for the following reason, okay? It demonstrates, does Erasmus know that that codex exists? Yes. So whatever he thinks of, he clearly does not find it to be a valuable witness because he's going to disregard the witness of Codex Vaticanus and ultimately include 1 John 5:7 in the text of acceptance. Okay? So this document has a known existence. And it's known existence. It is known to exist for a while. And in 1521 we have a concrete reference point of somebody seeking it out for a research purpose. Okay? In this case, it is Erasmus as he is compiling his third edition of the Greek New Testament. Okay? So there's this one has a known history. It's known to exist from 1475. Erasmus is referencing it in 1521. Whether he went himself or just wrote the librarian, he knows it's there. He's ultimately going to reject a ton of readings that are found in Codex Vaticanus, okay? So that sets it apart differently from Codex Sinaiticus, okay? So let's just pause there. Do you have any questions or comments about any of that? I'm still on point one there about the conventional wisdom. Sir?
Being that the Constantinople is involved here, wasn't there a debate of two churches Roman Catholic Church, or was it a debate?
That was that's later on.
Okay, so is it, I was wondering if that came, seeing two churches was involved at all within this.
This, okay, so when I say later on, it depends on your point of view. The split between the Eastern Orthodox and the Roman Catholic Church happens before 1475. The exact year escapes me. I want to say like 1099. I'm getting that date confused with the date of the Norman conquest of England, and I don't want to do that. But yeah, there's a definitive point in time where the Roman Catholic Church is going to split from what becomes the Greek Orthodox Church. Okay, but that's happening before 1475. That had already happened before Luther's Reformation in 1570.
So the different codexes are not a factor, and the two different churches did not bear on the codexes.
Well, I would say that's a loaded question, because ultimately they do, in the sense that the Roman Catholic Church is going to use what is known as a Western text, which is going to follow certain readings that the Latin Vulgate was based on, and the Greek Orthodox Church is going to use what is commonly referred to as the Byzantine text. Okay? Now, the Byzantine text differs from the Alexandrian Western text. Okay? So when you set a King James Bible on the table and you set a modern version on the table, the reason why those differ in English is because of their Greek text basis. What Greek text are they using to do the translation? Okay? So the critical text theory is based largely on these two things that we're talking about here, Codex Vaticanus and Codex Sinaiticus. Okay? When I say Codex Vaticanus here, all I'm meaning to identify is that this is a document that is in the possession of the Vatican. The Roman Catholic Church is the holder of this document and still is to this day. I hope that answers your question. Hopefully without him making a bunch of new ones. 1054, okay? When was the Norman invasion? Somebody look that up, because now it's bothering me. Anyway, let me know when you find the answer. In 1809, interesting point of history here, just had to include it. In 1809, Napoleon takes Codex Vaticanus to France as a spoil of war. So he conquers in Italy, and he takes the Codex back with him to France as a spoil of war. In 1815, the Codex is returned to the Vatican library in 1815, okay? And then from 1828 through 1838, it is under the control of Cardinal Angelo Mai, who is involved in producing a typographical facsimile. Okay, remember we talked about that already. Okay, so he is largely the custodian of it for that 10-year period as he's working on assembling the information for the typographical printing. In May, did you get the date?
1066.
Yeah, I knew it was something like that. In May 1843, who saw it?
Tischendorf
saw Codex Vaticanus. Okay? Before he goes on his whirlwind adventure, in 1845, Tregellis saw the Codex. And I want to read you something about that. Somehow I ended up with two markers. So I read from Sorensen's book, Neither Oldest Nor Best, and he says the following. After his visit to the Vatican in 1845, Tregellis said the following. They would not let me open it without searching my pockets and depriving me of my pen, ink, and paper. And at the same time, two prelects kept me in constant conversation in Latin, and if I looked at any page too long, they would snatch the book out of my hand. Okay? So do they want him necessarily looking at it?
Yeah.
Apparently not. Okay? So these are the known facts in the conventional wisdom about it. Okay? Then, in 1857, Cardinal Mai
publishes the facsimile.
Okay, everybody with all that? So, what's the earliest known date of the Codex? 1475. Okay. Erasmus is aware of it, 1521. Napoleon takes it to France in 1809. He returns it in 1815. It's under the control of Cardinal Mai from 1828 to 1838. He's working on preparing the facsimile. Tischendorf is allowed to see it in May 1843. And in 1845, Tregellis sees it, and then in 1857, the Vatican publishes its facsimile, okay? Scrivener, in 1861, said the following about it, okay? Codex Vaticanus, 1209, is probably the oldest large vellum manuscript in existence, and it is the glory of the Vatican Library in Rome. To these legitimate sources of deep interest must be added the almost romantic curiosity with which has been associated with the jealous watchfulness of its original guardians, and whom an honest zeal for its safe preservation seems to have now degenerated into a suspicious, capricious willfulness, and who will show a strange incapacity for making themselves the proper use of a treasure, they secretly permit others more than to gaze upon it. It is so jealously guarded by the papal authorities that original visitors see nothing of it but in the red Moroccan binding. Okay, so in other words, are they letting anybody see that? See the actual codex? Is everybody with all that? Any questions about that before we move on to the next point? Okay, so let me wake this computer back up so we can get our graphics back up. Now, in February 2015, so 2 years ago, a little more than 2 years ago, in February 2015, the Vatican digitized the Codex. And are we going to work? Please work. Should find it on 2. Okay, so this is the Vatican website, and this is the digitized version of Codex Vaticanus. Okay, so again, February 17, 2015, the Vatican released photos of the Codex online. Okay, now you have to understand something here. Before this, few Protestant scholars were even allowed to examine it. Okay? Westcott and Horn, all these guys, when they're doing the revision, they are not doing it with having the original codex in front of them. They're doing it based upon typographical facsimile reprints. Okay? And let me just add to that. In the middle 1800s, these facsimiles are not like facsimiles that you and I know today. Right? So I have in my library at home a 1560 reprint of a Geneva Bible. Okay? So what they did is they took an original 1560 edition, digitally scanned every page, and then printed them out to match exactly with the way that Bible looked in 1560, right? Now, in the middle of 1800s, when all this is going on, do they have the technology and the capacity to do that? No. Okay? So before this, before the year 2015, few Protestant scholars were even allowed to see it. So that means that for 150 years, text scholars, including Westcott and Hort, had never actually seen the codex. They never saw the actual codex, okay? They were just using transcribed typographical facsimiles. Scholars saw the reproduced text, but they never saw the text of the actual codex, okay? Now, at the beginning of every biblical book, so this is the beginning of the book of Ephesians. Just right here. Okay? This is the beginning of the book of Ephesians. Okay? At the beginning of every biblical book in Vaticanus, there is what is known as a drop cap. Okay? You see this fancy lettering? This is a drop cap. Okay? Look in your Bible. What's the first word of the book of Ephesians? What is the first word in the book of Ephesians?
Paul.
It's Paul. This right here is the Greek letter for the first letter of Paul's what? Name. So this is the P, as it were, and then the rest of his name is here on the line. Okay? So this is what is known as, this is a feature that is known as a drop cap. So at the beginning of every biblical book in Vaticanus, there is a drop cap for this sort of fancy lettering. And you can see that they're printed in color. This bar and the drop cap itself, this is all in colored ink, while the rest of the page, and you can see it here in the cutout, the rest of the page is just what? It's just black. Okay? The thing you need to understand is that these drop caps are integral to the text. Okay? What that means is they were created when the initial manuscript was prepared. Okay? So if I'm writing out Paul's name, the equivalent would be, there's the P, and then on the line I have what? I probably didn't do that. This would probably be sitting more like this. Right? So that's in English what you're looking at here in Greek. Okay? So that is, these drop caps in Codex Vaticanus, they are integral to the text. That means they were created when the initial manuscript was prepared. They were not added at a later date after the fact. Okay? Now, Sorensen says, in his book, Sorensen says that drop caps are a medieval feature. Let me read this to you. Some more information about initials or drop caps. It says, in an illuminated manuscript, initials with images inside of them, such as those illustrated here, are known as historiated initials. They were invented of the insular art of the British Isles in the 8th century. Does anybody see a problem here?
Yeah.
This thing is supposed to be a what?
Old.
Fourth century codex. Yet it has integral drop caps that are indicative of a later medieval what? Practice. Everybody with that? Okay. The other thing is, where did this practice originate? It originated in the British Isles, not Alexandria, Egypt. Oh, but that's just technicality. We're not supposed to pay attention to that. Okay. The classical tradition was slow to use capital letters for initials at all. In surviving Roman text, it is often difficult even to separate words, as spacing was not used either. Now, if this is a 4th century codex, is it a, would it count as a classical codex? It would have been written in the 300s AD. Okay? What these guys are saying is that the practice of using drop caps or initials was not even a thing until the 7th century, which would put it at a minimum into the 600s AD. Okay? And it wasn't even a practice the practice was first invented in the British Isles, not in Alexandria, Egypt, not in the region that they're saying this codex is supposed to have come from. Is everybody with that? Now, do you see? Look at this. If you can't see that yourself, are you going to be aware of that problem?
No.
Probably not. Okay?
Why they wouldn't let them look?
Now, so a few more minutes to say. Sorensen said that this means one of the two, this means one of the following. Either one, it was written during the medieval era, or two, it was modified and rewritten in the medieval era. Either way, from an analysis of the codex itself, it would certainly appear that the thing is not what? It's not as old as they're what? It's not as old as they're saying it. Okay? Everybody with that? So according to Sorensen, the manuscript dating from the 4th to 5th century, or manuscript dating from, excuse me, the 4th to 5th century had little, if any, textual artwork. And I want to read from page 135 here. It says the following about this. He says other ancient manuscripts dating from the 4th and 5th centuries either have no textual artwork whatsoever, or what little there is, it is simply what he calls curly-cue doodles in black ink, almost always at the end of the book, where there was little space left over on the parchment. In no other ancient documents of the 4th and 5th centuries that this author has researched is there colored textual artwork or drop cast. Now, I've got to be careful here, because he certainly hasn't looked at every 4th and 5th century manuscript that's existed. So we do have to be, have some caution here. But he does say, in no other ancient document of the 4th and 5th centuries that this author has researched is there colored textual artwork or drop cast, particularly integral to the text. Full color initial drop caps as a literary device were unknown in the time frame when Vaticanus was purported to have been produced. Once again, the artwork of the initial drop caps in Vaticanus is clearly medieval in character. Okay? So what that means then is, if that's true, what that means is that that thing is not as old as it was. They're saying it is. Is everybody with that? Okay? Inconsistent handwriting. The next point. Portions of the codex are written in lowercase, minuscule writing, whereas other portions of the codex are written in uppercase, uncial writing. This is Ephesians. This is all uppercase, uncial handwriting. Okay? Now compare that with the first half of Genesis. Okay, so I'm going to get rid of that. No, wrong move. Hang on. I'm going to get rid of this. So here's Genesis 1:1. Does this handwriting look the same? It doesn't look the same. Why? Because this is lowercase handwriting. The other thing we saw was what? Uppercase handwriting. And I want you to also notice something. Does this drop cap look the same?
No.
No color, and is this one far more ornate in its decoration than the one we looked at just a moment ago? Okay? So portions of Codex Vaticanus are written in lowercase minuscule writing, whereas other portions are written in uppercase writing. So here's what I'm talking about. This is the first half of Genesis. The first half of Genesis is written in lowercase script, whereas the second half is written in uppercase script. So the middle of the book of Genesis, it switches from minuscule lowercase script to now uppercase uncial script halfway through the book of Genesis. And then it remains uppercase all the way until you get to the book of Hebrews. And then Hebrews and Revelation are once again in the lowercase font. Now look at Genesis. Look at the drop cap there in Genesis. And then I just want to show you by way of comparison to the handwriting and the drop cap. We're going to go all the way to Revelation, this is the beginning of the book of Revelation in Codex Vaticanus, and you will notice again it has what kind of drop cap? And again, the handwriting is what? Lowercase, just for visual comparison purposes. Again, let's go back to Ephesians. There you have Ephesians again.
Does the drop cap look the same at all?
No.
No. Is the script different? Okay. So this suggests at least more than one, potentially more than one scribe. This suggests a possibly later tampering. This suggests a whole host of things that are frankly unanswerable at this point. The point of me bringing it up is just to show you that when the text critics make definitive statements about these things, they're asking you to believe things that have not conclusively been what?
Proven
at all. Okay? So you have handwriting issues. Okay? So what this does is it raises basic questions about the integrity of the manuscript. Because they're suggesting that we should make wholesale changes to the Bible needed to be made based upon this codex, because it is supposed to have come from when? The 4th century. There's reason to doubt its age. There's reason to doubt its reliability based upon goofy things that are actually going on in the codex. Everybody following that? Missing books. Remember how we saw that Codex Vaticanus, or excuse me, Codex Sinaiticus was missing. That it cut off in like 1 Chronicles 17:9 or something like that, and then it picked up in Ezra 9:9, and it cut out the end of 1 Chronicles, all of 2 Chronicles, and the first portion of Ezra. Remember, I showed you that in the last lesson. You checked that. Hopefully you remember that, okay? In this one, see if you can figure out what's missing. So, the Pauline epistles start here. And they end here with 2 Thessalonians. Tell me what's missing. So here's the beginning of Paul's epistles. Here's the end. What's missing?
Timothy, Titus, Philemon.
1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, Titus, Philemon, all missing in Codex Sinaiticus. Codex Vaticanus. Not there. Four of Paul's epistles are not in it. But again, this is supposed to be the oldest and best witness to what the New Testament is supposed to be. So-called oldest and best, but yet there are things that are totally missing from the so-called oldest and best that yet find themselves in modern version. The inconsistency is maddening. Okay? The inconsistency in the application of the so-called rules is just extremely frustrating. Okay? Now, let's go on to the next one. Missing books, pagination. Inserted pages and changed pagination. So, Ron, this is Ephesians though, right?
On
Ephesians?
Yep. Okay. So I was talking about later tampering.
What's the issue?
Eight.
Huh? The upper right hand corner of Ephesians 1. What's the problem?
Got a different number there.
Someone has struck through the original page number and what? So, somewhere along the line, was something added to the codex in some way, shape, and form to cause the page numbers to be off and some scribe to change the page numbers. Now, maybe it was a mistake. It could have been a mistake originally. I don't know. I don't know the answer to it right now. But the point is, when you look at, now what you start doing is you start building a case here, right? You've got the drop cap issue. You've got the different script issue. You've got the different style drop cap issue. You've got the missing books issue. Now you've got page number changes and what seems to be added pages and changing of page number and pagination. And now you start saying, is this thing really what? Is it reliable? Is it really a reliable witness to the Old Testament? And is it really as old as they say it was? Okay? Now, in the book of Acts, as I just said, and I didn't just say this, I showed you Ephesians, but this changing of the page number also happens in the book of Acts, and it seems to speak that inserted leaves seem to have confused or muddled or changed the pagination, but it seems to be indicative of some sort of modification or later tampering, although the answer right now is, again, is inconclusive, okay? The fourth one is wormholes and overwriting. Codex Vaticanus contains natural and unnatural wormholes. Now remember we talked about wormholes when we looked at Codex Sinaiticus, okay? There are examples where the text goes around the wormhole, which again is indicative of a situation where the scribe putting the text on the page is altering the line so that he misses the what? The wormhole, okay? So there's some of that sort of thing, okay? Wormholes are also isolated from each other. So for example, let's say there's a wormhole in this page. Under normal wear, should there be a matching wormhole in this page as well as a matching wormhole in this page? Okay? But what ends up happening is there will be a wormhole in that phase, but not the phase before or after. Okay? So again, we have puzzling things here with this codex. Okay? There's other places, and I could show you an example, but I don't remember what reference to look at because I forgot to write it down, where there is clear overwriting, where somebody came in after the fact, overwrote something, and or added things to the margin, just like what we saw with Codex Sinaiticus. Okay? So, what time is it?
Well, you got a lot of time.
So I want to offer concluding thoughts first on Vaticanus. And then I want to offer a second round of concluding thoughts sort of on all six of these lessons. Does that make sense? Okay, so regarding Vaticanus. Codex Vaticanus appears to be a medieval creation, not an ancient one. Is there strong reason to think that this is not as old as they claim?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If this is true, it is not older. Let's say that drop caps were invented in the 7th century. That means the earliest this thing could be is from what? The 600s. We know that it did. There's no known record of existing before when?
1475.
Which, by the way, is a medieval date. Okay. So, let's say, even if you go with 600, are there other manuscripts that speak to the writing of the New Testament that would be pro-Textus Receptus King James that are that old? You follow what I'm saying? So the point is, if this thing is even if it dates from the 600s, then their full argument about it being one of the 50 Bibles commissioned by Constantine the Great and it being a 4th century codex, possibly even done in the same scriptorium as Codex Sinaiticus, and all the stuff that they say about it is totally what?
Bogus.
Totally bogus. Okay? Did we already look at last time that they were ranking archaic Mark as a Category 1 manuscript to Mark when the whole thing was a fake the whole time? Indisputable fake, proven by the University of Chicago to be a fake. I printed out 100 pages just this week on the forensic analysis of archaic Mark. That's a very exciting life. But my point is that this stuff is all speculation. They don't really know how old this thing is. And from its known existence, it has been under the express guardianship of who? Of the Roman Catholic Church. Okay? So let me go back to my notes. So if it is true that it is a medieval creation, then it is no older than many of the manuscripts supporting the Textus Receptus. So it could have been done any time from the 600s, any time of 14 what?
75.
Okay? I'm going to say to you, if you compare, it is clear to me that if you compare these drop caps with the ones in Genesis and the ones in Revelation, someone altered it at some point. Okay? They don't look the same and they wrote in different handwriting. But again, they come in. Erasmus, point three. Erasmus knew of the existence of the Codex in 1521. So the idea that this is some new ancient discovery, the idea that this is some new thing that is going to change the way that we fundamentally understand the Bible, because we were able to go further back in time and get closer to the original and more accurately reproduce the original because we have this older manuscript. That whole thing is completely bogus. That thing was known to have existed from 1475, and Erasmus consulted it in 1521 in making editorial decisions on the third edition of the Greek New Testament. Okay? So that means, all the way through, from 1521 all the way to 1881, when the revised version came out, was Codex Vaticanus known to have existed? Yeah. It's not. So, the only so-called real new thing is whether or not Codex Sinaiticus is what? Now, let me say just a few things about that. In the 1800s, so we talked a lot in this in class about the years 1860 through 1900. Remember that? Remember when we did that? We talked about the change in the Protestant interpretation of the Bible that took place between 1860 and 1900. We went over that in class, right? No, in this era, no Protestant scholar worth his salt is going to agree to fundamentally change the Bible based upon one lone Vatican document. It is only after they now have what?
Only the other one.
The other one. His twin sister, or his ugly stepsister, Sinaiticus, that now all of a sudden they feel they have a textual base to do what? Change it. Okay? The document, Vaticanus, has been under Roman Catholic control since its first known existence in 1475. And that Protestant scholars would use it to supplant the text of the Reformation is beyond my ability to comprehend. I'm going to be teaching a lesson in a conference coming up in October, and I just changed the name of it. Some of you might have saw it on Facebook. I just changed the name of it to Pilfering the Power of the Protestant... No. Pilfering the Power of the Paper Pope of Protestantism. You want to know when the Reformation went in the tank? It's when they switched the traditional text of the Reformation for the new and improved text of textual criticism. I have, folks, I am assembling quote after quote after quote of pro-Roman Catholic scholars hailing the Revised Version of 1881 as the best thing to ever happen in Christendom, and how it was going to lead to ecumenical return to unity between Catholics and Protestants. This whole idea that none of the differences matter and all this sort of thing, that is a modern lie. The people that were living back there when that stuff was going on, they absolutely believed there were doctrinal differences between their King James Bible and what was done in 1881. They absolutely believed that. So you have to come for that message to hear the rest of that, I guess.
Okay.
But my point here is both of these. Now the case right now about Vaticanus is much more up in the air. More work has to be done on it, okay? Because it's a different situation. We know it existed back to 1475, right? But even if you take that as the earliest known date, are there reasons to still doubt the conventional wisdom about it? There are tons of reasons to doubt the conventional wisdom about it, right? But you have to understand that the modern critical text is fundamentally based upon the work of Westcott and Moore. When Westcott and Moore did their work, they put the majority of the emphasis on what two codices? The Vatican Codex and what? The Sinaitic Codex. I already told you that when they did that, neither one of those guys had ever seen the original documents. All they were working off was typographical reprints and facsimiles. They never handled the actual things. They never saw them themselves. We can see more about what's going on living in the 21st century because of internet technology and photographic images that are on the internet than those guys actually saw when they sat down to fundamentally change the Bible between 1870 and 1880. Okay? Now, let's talk about the second round of the conclusions. And that is sort of about this whole thing. Okay? Well, does anybody have any questions or comments about that before we go to the next point? Because I still have 15 minutes, and I think I can do what I need to do in about 15 minutes. Okay, so there's no questions, so that's perfect. Objections. Simonides
Constantine Simonides claimed, so I'm back up here on Codex, so this would all be Codex Vaticanus, this would all be Codex Sinaiticus, right? Codex sin, no pun intended on that one, okay? But the Simonides claimed to have produced Codex Sinaiticus as a gift for the Tsar of Russia between 1839 and 1840. Okay. So there are three primary objections to that idea. So if you listen to James White, if you listen to people that are out there, they will raise three primary objections to Simonides having done the Codex in that time frame. The first one, objection number one would be no known exemplars. Explain what that means in a minute. Second, Alexandrian text. Third, not enough time. Okay? So let's take these one at a time. So these are the primary objections. Okay, objection number one, no known exemplars. What that means is that the readings that are in Codex Sinaiticus, that some of those readings are not found where?
Anywhere else.
Anywhere else. Therefore, what was Simonides what? Copying.
Vaticanus.
Is everybody? No, he wasn't copying Vaticanus. Although, Sorensen might make you think that if you read it. I should just say that the Sorensen book is what got me into this to start with. But as the more I've read this and reflected on it, I think there are major problems with this book. I think his major contribution is actually the stuff he's raising about Vaticanus, not the stuff necessarily about Sinaiticus. Because the stuff about Sinaiticus, I can read most of that stuff in other books. Okay? But anyway. So no known exemplars, that means, well, Simonides couldn't have done it because what was he copying? We don't know what his exemplars were that he was working off of to produce the readings found in Codex Sinaiticus. Okay, so let me just say something about that. Did Codex Sinaiticus include Greek Hermes and Barnabas? Had anybody seen Greek of Hermes and Barnabas before Simonides published it? So does that mean that he's got stuff in front of him that no one else had ever seen? If he's got Hermes and Barnabas in front of him that no one had ever seen, then is it reasonable to assume he's got other things in front of him that no one had possibly ever seen? You follow me what I'm saying? Okay? So the first thing of no known exemplars falls off the table when you understand what we know for sure is that he had that in front of him because he put it where? He put it in the Codex, and remember that he publishes standalone editions of both of these before Tischendorf found them in the Codex. We went over that, okay? So objection number one about no known exemplars is bogus, because whatever he has in front of him that he's copying, is he copying stuff that no one had seen or knew about before he copied it? Is everybody with that? Yes, no, maybe so? Amen, okay. Number two, Alexandria. What they'll say here is, well, Mount Athos is an island in Greece, or a peninsula in Greece. And the manuscripts that were available were Byzantine manuscripts, not Alexandrian manuscripts. So how is it that Alexandrian readings got into this document created in Mount Athos in 1839, 1840? Okay? That is making the assumption, that is making a few pretty significant assumptions, okay? Number one, it's assuming that they don't have any Alexandrian readings, which is not a safe assumption based upon what we've already observed about Hermes and Barnabas. Okay? And number two, we have to realize that Simonides, when he does this, is something like 20 years old, give or take.
He is working with Uncle Benedict. You remember this, right? He's working with Uncle Benedict. Let me read to you from, this is found this week too, with the help of Stephen Avery, a graphic memoir of Constantine Simonides from 1859. Okay, bibliographic, excuse me. Page 4. Benedict, who was a most accomplished scholar and a great linguist. Benedict was a teacher of religion in many parts of Greece, as well as so highly esteemed at Papadistrias that he received at his hands an appointment of professor of doctrinal theology. The 20-year-old Simonides is largely copying what Benedict is what? Putting in front of him. The school that Benedict is a professor at just so happens to be located in Turkey at the time. He is a professor for 35 years. As he's professoring, he is assembling and collecting what? Documents. Okay? Is it most often the case that the professors are more liberal than their students?
Mm-hmm.
The readings, the responsibility for the Alexandrian readings in the Codex are fully explainable by the academic career of Uncle who? Benedict. Not to mention, what really is the Alexandrian text? Okay? What really is it? Recall that conventional wisdom holds that Sinaiticus, along with Vaticanus and several other old manuscripts, were of the Alexandrian textual family. This is a presumption that as they were copied in or about Alexandria, Egypt, in the 4th century. However, the conclusion that Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, Beza, and Alexandrinus are all Alexandrian is a highly subjective opinion. The so-called Alexandrian text family is highly amorphous, that means not the same, and disparate, disparate, that means they don't agree, okay? Though there is general agreement that Vaticanus was initially produced in Alexandria, It is dissimilar in its textual variation when compared with Sinaiticus. Dean Burdi, a conservative Bible-believing textual expert in the 19th century, wrote an entire book on the disparate differences between Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. Okay? As you read in the quote below, recall that the names Vaticanus was V and Sinaiticus was L. He says, quote, "And it matters nothing that they are discovered on careful scrutiny to differ essentially not only in 99 out of 100 of the whole body of extant Greek manuscripts." What Bergen is saying is that these two codices, they differ from 99 out of 100 of the entire available number of what? Greek manuscripts. Okay? Then he goes on to say, but even from one another. In the Gospels alone, Vaticanus is found to omit at least 2,877 words, to add 536 words, to substitute 935 words, to transpose 2,098 words, to modify 1,132, in all, 7,578. The corresponding figures for Sinaiticus being 3,455 omitted, 839 added, 1,114 substituted, 2,299 transposed, and 1,265 modified, in all 8,972. And it be remembered that the omissions, additions, substitutions, transpositions, and modifications are by no means the same in both. Okay? It is, in fact, easier to find two consecutive verses in which the two manuscripts differ, the one from the other, than two consecutive verses in which they entirely agree. And so there you have it, folks. Based upon that evidence, we have changed the whole what? Understanding what the Bible is. So, we've dealt with the no-no exemplars. The Alexandrian test objection is logically explainable. So then we have the what? There's no way that a 20-year-old in a year, 1839, 1840, is going to have time to produce the entire what? The entire Bible. Okay? So I already said up here for Alexandrian text that Benedict's 35-year career, gotta hurry up, as a scholar and linguist is responsible for explaining, can explain the Alexandrian text reading debt, if whatever that even is, okay, that was the point of reading from Sorensen. But in 1859, after Tischendorf found the Codex Sinaiticus in 1859, in 2 months, March and April of 1959, with the help of two other Germans, he copied the entire thing. 110,000 lines of text. In how many months? Okay? But Simonides couldn't have done it himself in a whole year. But Tischendorf can copy the whole thing in 2 months. Yeah.
Did Simonides write other material during that time period so that he could actually compare like a handwriting expert to say, well, it looks like, you know, he wrote this codex, he wrote other things?
So that's an interesting question. I'll answer that when I'm done with the recording. Okay?
Sure.
In 1866, Tischendorf was granted access to the Vatican. And he's granted access to Codex Vaticanus for 14 days, for 3 hours a day. So how much time is that, you math geniuses? That's a total of 42 hours. Okay? In 42 hours, Tischendorf copied the entire New Testament of Vaticanus by hand. For what he was preparing to publish in 1867. Okay? But there's no way Simonides could have done Codex Sinaiticus in a whole year when these other guys can accomplish these Herculean feats in 42 hours and 2 months. Okay? Frederick Kenyon says in his book, Our Bible and Ancient Manuscripts, he says the following about Tischendorf. In 1866, Tischendorf once more applied for leave to edit the manuscript, but with difficulty obtained leave to examine it for the purpose of collating different passages. Unfortunately, the great scholar so forgot himself as to copy out 20 pages in full, contrary to the conditions under which he'd be allowed to access the manuscript, and his permission was naturally withdrawn. Renewed entreaty produced him 6 days longer study, making in all 14 days of 3 hours each, and by making the most of his time, Tischendorf was able in 1867 to publish the most perfect edition of the manuscript which had yet appeared. He can do it in 42 hours, but Simonides can't do the whole thing in 1 year. Okay? So I'm going to just have to leave you with this. The only reason anybody thinks Codex Sinaiticus, the chief reason why anybody thinks Codex Sinaiticus is old is because of the paleographical estimation of Constantine von Tischendorf. It has never been tested, it has never been evaluated, and I told you about the canceled test and all of that stuff. So I've got to wrap this up because that video is going to cut off. But we just cut off from that. My point is, who are we going to trust here? Are we going to trust a bunch of text scholars to give us the Bible? Or are we going to trust that God did what he said in his word and preserved it? Because if we're going to trust what God said in his word that he preserved it, then he's given us markers and understanding in his word that helps identify where that preservation was.
where that preservation is and where that preservation is located. I don't trust what these guys are telling me. And I don't think you should either. Okay? We got to quit. So, we done on the answer your question?